This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
I love my school. You know, I got to start under the great Pete Carroll. I think college sports is an amazing thing. You know, it gives you a strong work ethic.
Bob Demars played football at USC from 1997 to 2001. He started only two games. Still, he took a lot of hits. Repairs were costly.
You know, I started kind of adding up my body parts. You know, my knees, my back, my shoulder. These are just some of the things that are inherent to a violent sport. And I started wondering if, you know, if we added all that up, would that outweigh the benefits of my free education?
Demars studied business administration at USC. After graduation, he became a filmmaker, and he started thinking about producing a documentary about those body parts and how they weren't working as well as they once had, and how he was on the hook for rebuilding them. He might have continued along that line if he hadn't suddenly found himself with a house guest and a more pressing issue to confront.
Everything changed when a guy named Scott Ross came and lived with me. My roommate asked if his buddy could crash on the couch for a while. That was supposed to be a week, you know, and 7 months later, it was like, all right, Scott, you know, what's the plan here?
After graduation, Scott Ross had found himself a good job. He began building a career. He was married. He had a family. But by the time he showed up on Bob Demars' couch, that was all gone.
Scott Ross was linebacker next to Junior Seau when he played at USC. So he was a legend. You know, I'd seen him on the walls. He was an All-American. He was in all the defensive meeting rooms, like pictures of him everywhere. And when I met him, you know, he was a shell of those pictures that you see on the wall. He wasn't anything like that. You know, he was 39 years old. He just lost his job, and he was diagnosed with dementia at the age of 39.
Demars began thinking about including Scott Ross in his documentary. Unlike Demars, Ross had been a college star. Like Demars, he'd suffered his share of injuries, some of them more obvious than others. At the time, Demars still felt his film would be about the knee, shoulder, and back issues, the stuff surgeons and physical therapists address. And then, in the middle of a working day, suddenly he had something else to worry about.
I was in a meeting at Jeremy Renner's company, not far from where I'm sitting right now. And we were in there. He wasn't actually in the meeting. We were meeting with his people, and they were pitching us things, and we were pitching them things. And it was a typical pitch meeting. And all of a sudden, you know, I felt the back of my head get warm. And the room got really long. You know, I was in this flannel shirt, and it just got really hot. It literally felt like somebody slipped me some type of drug because it was such a physical sensation. You know, I wanted to run out of the room, but I knew, you know, the part of me that was still there goes, wait a minute, that's crazy. You can't just run out of the room in the middle of a meeting. So I just sat there and I wrote it out. And, you know, luckily the two people that were talking in the meeting, you know, didn't ever notice because they were busy chatting it up.
If they were movie people, they were only listening to themselves.
Pretty much, right? You know, it's like, okay, everybody's just talking about their project, and you know, I'm sitting over here just like feeling like I'm dying.
Fortunately, Demars wasn't dying. He would learn that he'd had a panic attack. Neither Demars nor his doctors initially associated the attack with the concussions Demars had suffered playing football. Eventually, they would make that connection. Still, Demars wasn't sure he wanted to talk about it.
But the reality is, I can't ask Scott Ross to give me his warts and all, and then have me not to do the same.
It took a while to gather the money to make the documentary. Demars had to find the right doctors and experts, and he had to convince them to participate. As he was doing so, Scott Ross's condition was deteriorating.
You know, I think that is the hardest part in making this film. You know, I was somebody that Scott could call on when he needed help. And, you know, you get him on the phone, he'd be rambling and, you know, his thoughts would be really misplaced. And, you know, I'd get calls at 2 a.m, you know, where he would be in a really dark place. And, you know, he'd say, you know, if the handle on this bottle was, you know, trigger, I'd pull it. You know, my wife would be getting up at 5:30 to leave for work and I'd still be on the phone. But the day that we interviewed him, it was interesting because, well, first he was 4 hours late to the interview. You know, I flew this crew out there, you know, we're waiting in front of an IHOP for 4 hours and finally he shows up, you know, but for some reason that day when we interviewed him, it was almost like, I don't know, the powers that be, God, whatever you want to call it, gave him his brain back for one day. And he was just lucid, and he was speaking in sound bites, and for 5 hours, he was just on it.
In your whole career, how many concussions do you think you received?
I know the ones I can remember, 12. And I can't tell you how many times I blacked out on the field and shook my head and, you know, did one of those and tried to get my senses and walked right back to the huddle. And the whole next play, just sort of hoping they didn't run my way.
Scott Ross discussed the long-term and not-so-long-term consequences of those days on the field.
Right now, I take 8 Norcos a day. I have the 2 pain pills and a seizure pill.
He was on all sorts of pills. I mean, he had a whole giant, almost like suitcase-sized pill box for all of the conditions that came with all the violent collisions he had over the years.
And there's been a couple times when I didn't have access to my anxiety pills. And the only other thing out there was a can of Budweiser.
He would go into, you know, violent outbursts when he was drinking. That wasn't something that he had a problem with early in his life. You know, there were some things that he didn't want to talk about, mm-hmm. too. It's difficult for people to reconcile the person that they knew with the person that they've become. And, you know, Scott was loved by everybody. But after a while, you know, you'd have Scott around for a while. You'd be worried about your family or, you know, that he could have an outburst or something bad might happen. Or he might drink and go off the rails and you'd have to contain him.
At some points during the documentary, which is titled The Business of Amateurs, Ross seems to be just talking with a friend rather than speaking to the camera.
Hopefully, when you get to be in your 40s and 50s, you're okay. And you still have enough people around you to take care of you. Because the end will come. And you can't be a gladiator your whole life.
The interview went on for 5 hours. Scott Ross was able to keep it together throughout that time, and then it was over.
As soon as we dropped him off at the Motel 6, you know, he was completely wiped out. I mean, he could barely walk. Somebody with a brain injury like Scott, 5 hours is a lot. Mm. He gets wiped out. I mean, that's a big part of why he can't work anymore. You know, there's no system of support set up for any of these guys from college that deal with anything related to disability. In fact, it's still an NCAA violation for a school to help an athlete with disability.
How did you learn of his death?
His girlfriend called me. It was at 10:30 at night. His ex-girlfriend, Laura, was calling me. I knew what it was. I just instantly knew that Scott was dead. And I think one of the, I guess, things that make me feel guilty about this film is I let it go to voicemail because I knew that I had to record it for the film. It's something difficult to reconcile with, but, you know, I miss my friend all the time.
Scott Ross died in September of 2014 while DeMars was in the middle of editing his film.
I'd been having talks with USC at the time, and you know, one of the administrators had said, well, what does Scott need? How can we help him? I know that USC would have stepped up and helped him if that wasn't a violation. I definitely had some anger there because, you know, his body was found in a church and had been sitting there decomposing for a week before somebody found him. I feel like a legend like Scott deserves more respect than that.
Bob DeMars hopes that including Scott Ross's story in The Business of Amateurs will alert athletes, their parents, and football fans not only to the risks players face, but to the responsibility DeMars feels the colleges, universities, and the NCAA should be assuming for the welfare of those players.
I learned a lot about college athlete rights. It's almost like I got my master's in it, spending the 3 years making this film. And I think it's, you know, when it comes to the things that aren't arguable, I think, you know, putting players' health first, you know, you can talk about salaries all you want. I think that's the last step, if it's a necessary step at all. You know, there's $1 billion in new revenue in the sport every year. We could cover all of our athletes for their injuries.
Even after the film was finished, DeMars didn't stop learning.
You know, we've had screenings of my film, and I've had about half a dozen of my teammates from USC came up to me after the screening, and they whispered in my ear, I have what you have. I know that there's guys that are out there suffering.
Football players at all levels know more about head injuries than they did a decade ago. Even the NFL has acknowledged connections between head injuries and conditions such as chronic traumatic encephalopathy, Parkinson's disease, memory loss, mood swings, and depression. And the documentary doesn't neglect all the other ways in which football can beat up those who play it. In The Business of Amateurs, Bob DeMars points out that the college game has lagged behind the NFL in terms of diagnosing, treating, and taking responsibility for all sorts of injuries. He's trying to bring to a larger audience the problems numbers of former college players face. It hasn't been easy or pain-free.
There's a certain amount of guilt that comes in knowing that, you know, Scott's story and losing Scott elevates the film to a certain degree. But at the end of the day, you know, Scott's story being shown in this film is really the silver lining that, you know, that his story may change the system. It may save lives, and it definitely put a bigger burden to get it right and to make sure that this film becomes Scott's legacy and his story lives on.
The Business of Amateurs is available now through iTunes, Amazon, and other pay-per-view and video on demand services. There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. Those are Chicago Cubs fans, and they're cheering, celebrating, because on Thursday, Chicago clinched the National League Central Division for the first time since 2008. That is up first on this week's Three Stories You Should Know. Joining me are Eric Malinowski of Bleacher Report via Skype and Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, tell us about the Cubs.
Well, whenever teams have gone a long time without any success, fans, by nature, irrational, illogical beings, always come up with an excuse to make sense of their misery. Fans often lean on bad luck, or in extreme cases, they rely on curses. Mm. And for much of their 86-year drought between championships, Red Sox fans sought the pity of the nation because of the curse of the Bambino. The Red Sox won that ring in 2004. Since then, we've seen the Chicago White Sox end a similarly long drought, which I might add has been totally forgotten by the masses. We've seen my hometown Kansas City Royals, shameless plug, end 30 years of misery. We've seen the Golden State Warriors end a 40-year drought. And we've seen the Cavaliers just end a 50-year championship drought for a city known as a mistake by the lake. But through all that, there have been the Chicago Cubs. They haven't been to the World Series in 69 years, haven't won a championship since Teddy Roosevelt was president. But that could finally come to an end. These Cubs have been the best team in baseball for most, if not all, of the season, and a prohibitive favorite to win it all. So I ask, if the Cubs can overcome the GOAT and the Bartman and every other concoction that's to blame for their drought, can we finally bury curses in professional sports?
I'm all for it. Let's end them all. As Michael might have been, I covered the Game 6 in Cleveland these past NBA Finals. As I was coming from the airport, go to downtown, I got off the light rail, and my train engineer said, you're here in downtown. Enjoy your day here. Go Cavs, and God help us all. And it's just that really just this is sort of the core nature of fandom. This sort of happy sort of irrationality. By the way, the idea that we could have a Cubs-Red Sox World Series for the first time since 1918. I mean, think about all of the significance there. I'm ready for it. Bring it on.
I'm thinking of an old friend, as the Cubs have succeeded so spectacularly, at least to this point. That's Lenny Marullo, who played shortstop for the Cubs back in the 40s. He was on the team that lost the World Series to the Tigers back in 45. He died a while back. I'm thinking of how much he would have enjoyed seeing the Cubs be the first club to clinch a division title this season. And I'm going to root for the Cubs from here on in on his behalf. I hope that'll be okay with all my friends and associates in Boston, but that's what I'm going to do.
Since my Royals are done, why not? Go Cubbies.
Eric, I understand you've been doing quite a bit of reading about a particular profession this week.
That's right, Bill. With college football season recently kicking off, there were a couple of recent profiles that caught my eye. One was for The Ringer. They went long on Michigan head coach Jim Harbaugh, who, as much for anything else, is known for his nonstop energy and antics on the sidelines. And just a couple days ago, for Bleacher Report, there was a pretty fascinating profile of Ohio State head coach Urban Meyer, who was pretty open about his mental health struggles over the past few years. What it really got me thinking about was sort of the state of college football and this perception about coaches. And I'm hypothesizing a little bit here, but I feel like maybe this is where the main appeal of college football kind of rests now. I mean, there have always been like pretty, you know, high profile head coaches in the sport, but they've taken the place where there used to be star players before. We've got guys like Christian McCaffrey and Leonard Fournette and Josh Rosen, but I think the common sports fan would be hard pressed to even know where these guys play. I mean, I think back to just the recent past where we had guys like Vince Young or Cam Newton, or dare I even speak his name, Tim Tebow. Now the stars of the sport are the guys on the sidelines that are already making the millions of dollars, not the guys who could be doing that in the NFL soon.
Michael, does that feel weird to you?
It does. Coming up, you know, I was a huge fan of the Miami Hurricanes, and there were just so many guys, just flamboyant characters. You had so many guys that just came out, and you saw their personality it was just radiating on the screen. And you wonder if the coaches are not allowing these guys to really show who they are. It seems like once they get to the NFL, you start to really see the characters kind of come through. But you wonder if that sort of led to the only thing you latch on to is the coaches, because they're the guys that are consistently there.
I don't think this is a new development. I mean, Newt Rockne, Bear Bryant, Bud Wilkerson, Bo Schembechler, Joe Paterno, all these guys were far better known than anybody who played for him. We were fooling around in the office trying to think of how many guys we could think of who played for Newt Rockne besides George Gipp, and nobody could come up with anybody. But Eric, I'll give you the opportunity to tell me I'm wrong and wrap this up.
No. You're right. This has always been sort of part of the fabric of college football. I guess my feeling is that I think these two things used to just be in a little bit more balance. Maybe not even sure it's ever been quite 50-50, but I just feel like maybe there was a time when the players might have been a little bit more uneven playing field, but it certainly doesn't feel that way anymore.
My story comes from a non-story, or what I at least consider a non-story. Through a hack into WADA's database, we learned that the Williams sisters and Simone Biles had been granted exemptions to use medicine that's on the list of banned substances for Olympians. Move along now, nothing to see here, because lots of athletes get exemptions so they can use medications for asthma, ADHD, and all sorts of other conditions. And of course, a lot of athletes still cheat. So I wonder if it's time to review the whole business of policing athletes in this area. Is it time to say they're entitled to use any substance that you or I could get with a doctor's prescription? Athletes, teams, even National Olympic committees determined to work the system certainly can employ doctors who will prescribe on demand, but they do that now, and I'm not sure that would be a change. So why pick and choose which substances approved by a doctor are allowed in sports? Anybody ready to sign on to my revised streamlined protocol?
Well, I know I'm a little conflicted, because I think as fans, we often just want to be entertained, and if somebody's willing to, you know, shorten their life to entertain me, I guess that's okay.
But that was very blunt.
I know that sounds very cold, but yeah, I think we get into over policing. You know, you want to make sure that we can appreciate human achievement, you know, naturally. I'm sort of conflicted because I'll tell you, I love seeing Barry Bonds smash 73. So, and I'll just leave it there.
Well, as long as we're not talking about the shady doctor who signs off on Donald Trump's health reports, then I'm all in favor of doctor prescriptions and letting athletes, you know, be exempt for all sorts of things. I mean, this is the kind of thing where my mind always ends up inevitably on things like LASIK eye surgery. You're still talking about a technique that can take a person that has, you know, 20/200 vision, and they can end up with 20/15 vision. You know, as long as those are the sorts of things that are not going to be questioned and are going to be readily accepted, then heck yeah, let's exempt all sorts of things as far as I'm concerned.
I think we have made our point, and we can look forward to practically instantaneous change and raised consciousness on the part of WADA and USADA and all the rest of the bureaucrats sitting around counting blood types and things like that, don't you think?
FIFA will be proud.
All because of you. You should pat yourself on the back.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been Eric Malinowski of Bleacher Report and Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports. Fellas, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Next, we have a story about two brothers, Edmi and Eddie. Their names sound pretty similar, and for a while, their lives were, too. They came of age in Odessa, a blue-collar oil town in West Texas, and in Odessa, street racing is a way of life. Here's reporter Asa Merritt.
We're lining up with the Ford F-250. I'm guessing his stuff is stock. Hey, bro, is your stuff stock? All right, he's got a tune into diesel. He has the turbo on. So we'll see how it goes. I'm pretty sure I can beat him, though.
I'm in a car with 23-year-old Edmi Sotelo. He's about to gun his Dodge Charger down a quarter-mile racetrack that's surrounded by oil rigs.
What do you think Eddie would think to see you? What would he say?
Oh, man, he'd be happy. Eddie would want to drive my car more than me. I'd probably let him, too, if he was here. I'd let him race it instead of me. You smell that fuel?
Emmy started racing when he was 15 or 16. He says for him, it all started with watching action movies with his brother, Eddie.
You know, we grew up with those movies, man. When those movies came out, kind of like, wow, people are doing it, you know? It's like it can happen, you can race, you know? So that kind of opened the door.
It don't matter if you win by an inch or a mile.
Here, especially in Odessa and the West Texas area, everybody knows about cars. Girls, guys, you know, just to distract yourself, and that's what everybody does over here.
There's not a lot of entertainment in this dusty one-industry town. So Odessans make their own. They cruise on long straight roads outside city limits that have code names like 9 Mile, County Line, and Mexico. They cruise in old Chevilles, tricked out Mustang 5s, non-stock GMC pickups loaded with nitrous. They cruise from red lights, from rolling starts. Some cruise to nothing but the panther purr of their car's engines. Some cruise to hip-hop.
The first time I raced, I kind of was dragged into it. I was a really scaredy cat. So it was with my cousin, and he had a race truck. He liked racing. He would be like, look, dude, just put your seatbelt on or just hang on because we're doing this. And he put his foot down, and we hit like 120 on his truck racing down a back road in Odessa. And I was like, wow, it's scary, but it feels good. And he's like, yeah, you want to try it? And then he's like, I'll let you borrow my truck. He showed me how to do it. He showed me what to do. And that's the start. And, man, it just consumes you, you know. It's just like it's a lifestyle. You get drawn to it instead of doing other things.
A few years ago, Edmi got married and had a kid. He started racing less and less. But Edmi's brother, Eddie, he fell deeper into illegal racing. Right around the same time, the brother's parents got divorced, and there was no one keeping track of Eddie at night.
My dad gave him an Expedition. He locked up the engine on the transmission. We thought it was a normal thing, you know. We didn't think he was racing. So my dad bought him a little Ford Ranger, and he messed up the transmission on that. And that's when we're like, okay, Eddie, what's going on, dude? Like, come on. He's like, no, it's because he would always find an excuse.
For Eddie's 18th birthday, Edmi and their dad gave Eddie a souped-up Nissan 350ZX. Last December, less than a year after he got the car, Eddie pulled up to a white Dodge Charger at a red light on University Boulevard. It was 2 a.m. When the light turned green, the two sports cars blasted down the city street at 120 miles per hour. Eddie hit a dip in the road.
And my uncle calls me. I'm like, what's up, Theo? I'm like, your brother, he's been in an accident. And I was like, okay, well, hospital's he at? I'm on my way. He's like, no, mijo, he didn't make it. And I was like, what do you mean he didn't make it? Like, yeah, look, just calm down. Take your time. Get your stuff. Get just slowly. Don't speed or anything. Come over here. Your mom and your grandma are waiting for you at your grandma's house. I get to the kitchen. I walk up to my mom. I get to the kitchen. I'm like, Mom, what's going on? She's crying. Like, crying. And she shows me a picture on her phone of the news of Eddie's car. That's when I get on my knees and I lose it. I just cry. Like, I can't. I cry and I'm like, I was just with them. Like 5 hours ago.
If Edmi had any lingering need for speed, it died with his brother. Edmi says he'll never street race again.
Once again, if you don't know what happened on that deal, Eddie Sotelo lost his life in a street race about 6 months ago there in Odessa.
We're at Penwell Knights Raceway. Penwell is a legal racing track just outside Odessa. One of Eddie's cousins approached the track about doing a memorial event to raise awareness about the dangers of street racing. Edmi had some reservations.
And I came in tonight kind of like, kind of skeptical about everything. I'm being honest. Like, we're going to come to the racetrack. You know, my brother's gone. And we're just here, you know.
More than 500 spectators and close to 100 racing cars showed up for the night's races. From 8 till past midnight, hot rods roared down the track.
But when I got here, I saw everybody smiling. All my family, especially his friends, because they knew him. They knew that side of Eddie that I didn't know.
Racing is so rampant in Odessa, police haven't been able to keep up despite assigning entire units to deal with the problem. Last year, Odessa PD made 115 arrests for reckless driving and street racing. In the first 6 months of 2016, they were already up to 71. For a city of only 100,000, that's a dramatic figure. Because cops have such a hard time policing street racing, tracks like Penwell are increasingly seen as a way to prevent accidents and save lives. That's why the track dedicated a night's racing to Eddie. Drivers have to wear seatbelts and a helmet. Staffers make sure nobody's been drinking. Paramedics and a fire crew are on site if a wreck does happen. One more safety rule is no passengers. The manager of the track made an exception for me that night. That's how I found myself lined up against an F-250 with Edmi at the wheel. Edmi and the family hope to make the memorial race an annual event.
I want to come down at least, you know, on the day of his birthday and get some runs in his name, you know.
A few months ago, after the memorial race, Ector County ruled on the racing resulting in death felony charges against Tyler Brooker. Tyler was the other driver in the accident. He faces no jail time, just 5 years probation.
Nice meeting you.
Oh, Margie, by the way.
Margie, I'm Edna.
After the ruling, Edmi met in a courtroom with Tyler, Tyler's mom, Margie, and Edmi's own mother, Myrna. This was the first time the families had gotten together in person. Edmi recorded the meeting for himself, but everyone who was in the room agreed to let some of the recording be aired here to help spread the word about the toll of illegal street racing. Edmi stayed mostly quiet as Tyler told him how it all unfolded. It started when Eddie hit a dip in the road.
And when he hit, he caught air. As soon as it happened, I ran and I checked him in the alley. And I checked and I tried shaking him to wake him up, but he wasn't waking up. And so, I ran back to my vehicle and I was telling people to call the cops.
After Tyler called the cops, he had another call to make, to his mom. Eddie's death hit her hard too.
I went on Facebook. We were told not to go on Facebook and don't read anything, but I mean, how can you not when you don't know anything about him? And that's the only way I got to know Eddie was through all Facebook postings, and I read everything that his friend said about him. And him and Tyler are so similar, and that's what I told Tyler. It's like everything that we're describing about Eddie is everything that Tyler basically is.
Like I said, I've always wanted to reach out to y'all, and just to kind of give y'all a sign. Like I said, I pray to Eddie every day.
Thank you.
I pray to him every day.
Edmi knows it easily could have gone the other way, and he has his own regrets.
Yeah, if I would have known he went so much into racing, I would have done something.
Edmi Sotelo is doing something now. He and Tyler Brooker are getting the word out together about what happened, telling their friends, offering forgiveness. They both know street racing is a way of life in Odessa, and they both want that to change. For Only a Game, I'm Asa Merritt.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style coming up on Only a Game, how a dangerous, sports-loving secret society ran roughshod over 1930s Detroit and got away with it.
J. Edgar Hoover had very little interest in investigating, and a whole lot of people got away with murder.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a Navy reservist who wanted to be a pilot and ended up in the NFL instead. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announced this week that the league will spend $100 million on concussion research. $60 million of that will go toward improving football equipment. Don't we already know that better helmets are not going to prevent concussions?
Well, I'll tell you, if they can find a material out of which they can make football helmets that prevent concussions, they should not waste time with football and just make body armor, because there is no way you can play professional football as it is presently constituted and not get concussions. There's no way.
Some members of the House want a closer look at claims that the NFL tried to unduly influence concussion studies. What are the concerns in the halls of Congress?
Well, in May, some Democrats on the House Energy and Commerce Committee charged that the NFL was monkeying with the research, including trying to get a $16 million grant pulled from Ann McKee, who's been the doctor, you know, at the front of this here at Boston University. And now the Republicans want an investigation into it. So I think we're reaching a
bipartisan
a piece of bipartisan amity here.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
It would appear that the NFL's Las Vegas gambit just might pay off in a very big way. This week, a Nevada oversight committee recommended $750 million in public funding for a new stadium for the Raiders. That's a lot of money. How are they going to come up with that?
What, in Las Vegas? Who knows?
I can't imagine.
I mean, I have no idea, but I suspect the slot machines will be paying off less often
maybe
over the next few years. Surprisingly, the Southern Nevada Tourism Infrastructure Committee recommended raising the hotel tax so they could spend it on the stadium.
Sure. I read this week of the first football player to lose an endorsement because he took a knee during the national anthem, and it was not Colin Kaepernick, right?
No, it was Brandon Marshall, a linebacker in Denver, who's lost not one but two endorsement deals because he was kneeling for the national anthem, and he intends to keep doing it.
Longtime Dodgers play-by-play guy Vin Scully will retire at the end of this season, and he has said he doesn't want to say goodbye 12 times. How would that have been even a possibility?
Well, he's not going to call the playoff games, which is really too bad.
Yeah.
And I hope he can be induced to say goodbye at least four times if the Dodgers make the World Series.
Charlie, the White Sox are not going to be in the World Series this time around, and they don't care. They'll go down in history this season anyway, right? They set a record the other night, and of course, they had some four-legged help.
I love this story. They set a record for the most dogs at a baseball game. They invited fans because there's plenty of good seats still available for the White Sox games this year. They invited fans to bring their dogs, and by God, the fans turned out.
Thousands.
It was amazing. They claimed, by the way, that 1,122 dogs were present, and I hope they all had a good time.
I'm sure they did. Dogs always have a good time as long as they're not left home.
Yeah.
Paralympians are not supposed to be as fast as Olympians, at least as I understand it, but four Paralympians ran the 1,500-meter race at the Paralympics in Rio faster than the guy who won the gold medal at the Olympics. How'd that happen?
Well, first of all, the four we're talking about are blind. So speed was not a thing, and the 1,500 is basically a strategic race anyway. So good for them, though. I mean, it's an interesting question now.
It is. It's fascinating.
As to whether or not these guys should be allowed to run the real Olympics.
Yeah, at least in that case. Washington Capitals superstar Alex Ovechkin said this week that he doesn't care if the NHL will participate in the 2018 Winter Olympics. He's going to play for Russia anyway.
That's right, because he has always lived in the Republic of Ovechkin. I think this is great. Let him find him, and Alex can, you know, go home and get the Russian mob on the NHL's behind.
Step one in Ryan Lochte's attempt to rehabilitate.
Sports!
It is not! He's an athlete and he was dancing. And that was step one in his attempt to rehabilitate his reputation. Took place on Monday on Dancing with the Stars. And it didn't go particularly well, I guess.
No, it didn't. Apparently there were protesters who stormed the stage.
Of course they did.
And at least five of them are now in the semifinals. No, that's not true. I made that one up. Yeah, Ryan Lochte is going to be a pariah for a while, I'm afraid.
And finally, Charlie, we have heard of basketball games in domed football stadiums and on aircraft carriers and in all sorts of other strange places. But I think maybe San Antonio Spurs guard Tony Parker has really upped the ante on this new territory.
Yeah, he brought the French team he plays for up to the top of a glacier, almost 2.25 miles above sea level in the Swiss Alps, where it was 37 degrees. And can I say it, Bill? They were very cold from the field in that game.
I'm just happy to learn that there still are some glaciers.
That's a great thing. And, of course, we're going to turn them all into basketball arenas now.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated these days, and he joins me each week on All New Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Commentator Mike Pesca has noticed, and how could he not, a certain controversy that started in the NFL.
When 49ers backup quarterback Colin Kaepernick first sat
during the preseason, during the national anthem. This was an action so shocking and so much in contravention of the trinity of God, country, and the NFL that actually that no one noticed. Because the trinity is more like a quadrilateral. God, country, the NFL, and TV cameras. But then everyone got a little passionate. The good for the young player finally showing a social conscience passionate, as well as Jimbo from Covington, you're on the sports animal type passionate. Kaepernick, after his initial forays into protesting, met with veterans, stuck to his guns, explained his motivations pretty well. But then a big change happened. Didn't seem like much, but by my estimation, changed everything. Instead of sitting, Kaepernick kneeled. Symbolic, yes, but what are we talking about? How to treat the flag, the ultimate symbol. Sitting is not active, it's passive. I'll sit this one out. It's not the message he wanted to deliver. But taking a knee, he genuflected. It is an active motion. It connotes active listening. After practice, the team gets together, huddles around the coach. He says, take a knee, and information is absorbed. So let's all take a knee and think about what to gain from all these protests, including Kaepernick's, throughout the NFL. The protesters should understand, and by and large, I get the impression that they do, just how upsetting their actions are viewed by many, many football fans. Even those who say that they have a right to speak take the flag as something that one does not speak out against. That said, detractors should realize the contradiction of berating a guy for not saluting a symbol of a country that stands for, among other things, the right not to salute symbols. The flag is big and bold, and there's enough white space on it to read into it what you will. But to me, all of this, added together, is not, in that dismissive sports cliche, a distraction. It is a welcome discussion point.
Mike Pesca hosts the daily podcast The Gist from Slate. He's a panelist on the sports podcast Hang Up and Listen, which posts every Monday.
A fly ball going out to short left field. Goslin comes in and he makes the catch.
There were reasons to feel very good about Detroit in the mid-1930s. One of them, according to historian and author Tom Stanton, was the Tigers.
They won the World Series in 1935.
Then there were the Red Wings.
They also won the Stanley Cup.
And the Lions.
They won the NFL title in 1935.
And the greatest boxer of his time, a fellow who grew up in Detroit.
Joe Louis was the uncrowned, undefeated heavyweight champion.
So in Detroit, it was the best of times, right? No other city could boast such a simultaneous embarrassment of riches in the realm of sports. And a good thing, too, because if ever a city needed diversions from the day-to-day routine in which its citizens were involved, it was Detroit in the mid-30s.
The market crashed in 29, and by 33, Detroit had an unemployment rate in the area of 40%. And so it was a tumultuous time. You had all these folks who had come from other countries, other parts of the country, struggling to survive. Folks who had come from the South, and folks who were Catholic and had come from Italy and elsewhere. And all of them struggling to keep jobs. And one way you could keep a job, if you were in a factory, was to belong to the Black Legion. And many folks did.
Perhaps you've never heard of the Black Legion. Lots of folks haven't, and some who have, well, they've found it convenient to forget what they knew.
But in its time, it was a huge deal. There were a couple movies that came out, and one starring Humphrey Bogart called The Black Legion.
Those Black Legion guys don't fool.
I'm not fooling either. You're going to quit that gang.
I can't get out. I've tried. They won't let me out.
The character played by Humphrey Bogart sounds terrified, doesn't he? And he has reason to be. The Black Legion, which Stanton describes as a more violent version of the Ku Klux Klan, was a secret organization dedicated to terrorizing minorities, particularly blacks, Catholics, and Jews. The Black Legion had as many as 100,000 members across four states. The Black Legion's popularity in Detroit coincided with the city's greatest sports era. And how people handled that circumstance illustrates the irrational ways in which fans sometimes behave. In Detroit, organized labor, opposed mightily by Henry Ford and his motor company, was another Legion target. The Legion also terrified lots of its own members. Witness the Bogart character's despair.
You can't go to the cops.
I can't. Oh, well, that's exactly what I'm going to do unless you quit that gang.
They'll kill you. They'll kill me for telling you.
The Legion's strategy was to lure potential recruits to a meeting, kidnap them if necessary, and then threaten them if they didn't join and swear they'd never tell anybody what they'd done. The Legion promoted racist theories, threatened union leaders, and beat members who tried to quit. And in the Detroit area alone, Legion members committed some 50 murders. One of their victims was an African-American laborer named Silas Coleman. He was shot to death in May of 1935.
On that very same day that Silas Coleman was killed, Jesse Owens set 4 world track records at Ann Arbor that very same day. And there were white folks cheering for Jesse Owens. But then just hours later, 15, 20 miles away in Pinckney, Silas Coleman is lured up there by some black legionnaires who simply want to know what it feels like to kill a black man. And he's lured out to the Ford Mill Pond, and he is released and hunted and shot and killed. One of the police officers, a Captain Ira Marmon, who was investigating, wanted to drain the Ford Mill Pond because he had been told that there were 7 or 8 other bodies that were in that pond. And Henry Ford denied permission to drain his pond and for that investigation to go forward.
In 1935, the integration of Major League Baseball was still over a decade away, but among the most popular Detroit Tigers were Hank Greenberg, who was Jewish, and Charlie Gehringer, a devout Catholic. The Black Legion gave them a pass.
These Black Legion members were sports fans, many of them anyways. In Detroit, the city was going crazy for their sport teams because they had suffered through the Great Depression, were still suffering through it, and the Tigers, Lions, Red Wings, Joe Louis were giving them something to cheer for. They were uplifting the spirits of the city. These guys in the Black Legion planned some of their crimes so that it didn't conflict with the Tigers' schedule, so they wouldn't miss a game. You know, if we're going to hang this guy, let's do it after the game. It's difficult to grasp how they reconciled these issues, but they found a way to do it.
The Legion may have infiltrated the Tigers by means of recruiting their player manager and future Hall of Famer, Mickey Cochran.
Mickey Cochran potentially was a member. One of his closest friends at that point was Harry Bennett, Henry Ford's right-hand man.
Harry Bennett was said to know everything there was to know about who leaned which way in the Ford works, including who was pro-union and who was in the Legion. Ford himself, well, you'll recall that he wouldn't allow the authorities to drain the pond they thought might be full of the bodies of the Legion's victims. Anyway, in 1936, during the summer after they'd won the World Series, the Tigers foundered. Perhaps for that reason, and perhaps because of the tension that gripped the city as revelations concerning investigation of the Legion began to surface, Mickey Cochran had what may have been a nervous breakdown. He couldn't sleep, he suffered from vertigo, and at mid-season he removed himself from the Tigers' lineup. Harry Bennett arranged for Cochran's admission to the Ford Hospital and subsequently a month-long rest in Montana. The team finished 19.5 games behind the Yankees. Like the Tigers, the Black Legion would slump. Some of the members of the Detroit Police Department were in the Legion, but some of the ones who weren't managed to put together an investigation. And
they found somebody who talked. There was actually a gunman who broke the vow of silence, and it started crumbling.
The gunman, whose name was Dayton Dean, had participated in at least 2 murders. He said he wished he'd never heard of the Black Legion. He also revealed plots to poison the food being delivered to Jewish neighborhoods and plans to assassinate a labor attorney, a mayor, and a newspaper publisher. In the end, nobody above the level of Dean and a couple of other dupes faced prosecution. Allegations that judges, law enforcement officers, and business leaders had joined the Legion were buried.
People scrambled for cover. J. Edgar Hoover had very little interest in investigating. And a whole lot of people got away with murder.
But Tom Stanton has carried on the investigation into the Legion and its business. His research involved going through over 1,000 pages of FBI and Michigan State Police documents, and he saw the same issues surfacing repeatedly.
The Legion was concerned about immigration, and the Legion was concerned about Second Amendment rights, and the Legion was continuously criticizing FDR, describing him as a socialist and as being un-American. The echoes of some of those issues exist, and it's frightening.
It's significant, I think, that Tom Stanton, the historian, uses the present tense. It's frightening, not it was frightening. Because just as fans in Detroit in 1935 lost their minds over the Tigers and the Lions, fans today still lose their minds over their baseball and football teams. Some of those fans in Detroit were characterized by ignorance, hatred, fear, and a twisted sense of what was American. But that didn't prevent them from rooting for people they'd sworn to hate, as long as those people were Hank Greenberg, Joe Louis, or Jesse Owens. It's frightening, Tom Stanton says. And again, I don't think he just means then. Tom Stanton's book, Terror in the City of Champions, is subtitled Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society That Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Bob DeMars, who describes his father's reaction when Bob told him that he has panic attacks stemming from his football concussions.
You know, I'd pick up the phone and he'd go, "Hey, Bob." And I'm like, "All right, you got to stop talking to me like I'm crazy here."
"Okay, Bob." I mean, right you are, Bob. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. And thanks for listening.